From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a young man fell into addiction and rocked the world of his comfortable, happy family. Lisa Hillman is a healthcare administrator who tells this very personal story in a book called Secret No More, a true story of hope for parents with an addicted child. Her life had been a kind of simple storybook, accomplished in her job, married to a mayor, the parents of a successful adult daughter. Their son fell into drug use and addiction, and in many ways it baffled her. How could this happen? Why? What was the right way to approach it and turn it all around? Her book explores the desperation, the pain, confusion, and the eventual work that helped lead to a better place. But it has not been easy. And in reading her book, it could not have been easy to dig deep and share those difficult times in her family's life. But she's done that, and she's hoping it helps other parents who go through what she has gone through. Lisa Hillman is my guest for the hour on Connections. Lisa, welcome to the program. How are you?
Evan, thank you. I'm great. And after that introduction, I think we're done.
No. We've got plenty to talk about here. I'd like you to kind of just set a little, I mentioned a little bit in the introduction, you know, how you were maybe a hectic life, you know, a lot of work, but a lot of fulfilling work for you, the kind that had your adrenaline going, a satisfying career, a strong, happy family, and then things started to turn. But kind of set the backdrop a little bit more for our listeners, what life was like and how that was all happening for you.
Sure. I will set that for your listeners. I'm a quote-unquote happily married lady today, just 49 years of marriage. But of course, all this broke about 10 years ago now when my son was a senior in high school. And at that time, I was chief fundraiser for a very large health system in Annapolis, Maryland. It was a growing health system. I loved my work. I was raising lots of money. I had a staff of a dozen. I had a board of 25 people. It was a fairly high profile, fairly responsible position, and I just couldn't get enough of it.
When it comes to your family situation, you have another child who's significantly older, and everything had gone pretty well for you there, right?
Yeah, Evan, part of the story is that until my son was in high school, it was a fairly quote-unquote normal family, a normal life. My daughter was 15. In fact, it was on her 15th birthday that Jacob, our son, was born. So they are exactly 15 years apart. And of course, I figured that this child, this baby, was put into my life late in my life as a special gift to me. Clearly, that set some expectations in my own life that this child would grow up and cure cancer, you know, build the next set of jets. This was a young man who would clearly do something wonderful in the world, and we loved raising him.
When it comes to deciding to tell this story, Lisa, you had to endure this, and we're going to talk this hour about what your son went through, how it impacted you and the rest of your family, how you attempted to deal with it, and the many ups and downs that come with that, that I think, unfortunately, more people than we realize around us will relate to. Is that why you wanted to write this? Because when it hits you, you wonder, how could it be us? But then you look around and you realize this addiction issue is certainly not limited. I mean, it is remarkable just how many people and how many families go through it.
Evan, that's an excellent point. When I started writing this book, I wrote it mainly because I had to. I had to sort of just get it out of my own soul. But as I was writing it, it occurred to me that all around me were other, particularly mothers and fathers, but particularly mothers who I saw silently suffering. I knew that they were having trouble with their children, and yet they weren't opening up to me or to anyone, nor was I. I mean, I was suffering the same feelings of isolation and shame and denial and guilt that actually the addict feels. So when I wrote the book, I did not know at that point that it would ever be published. At some point, I knew I would have to ask Jacob's permission to get the book published. But as I was writing it, I hoped that one day it might help other families.
Do you get the sense that it's doing that now?
Great question. And yes, I do. Thank you so much. The book came out in the spring, in May. And since then, thanks to some wonderful friends and good people like you, I have had some public talks and some talks at libraries and book clubs. Each time what I say to my own family is, all I need is one mom. If I go into a room and there are people there or I'm speaking anywhere, I just need one mom to make it worthwhile for me. And fortunately, everywhere I've gone, I've gotten at least that one mom. Several emails, several families have come to me and thanked me. This is pretty humbling for me because it's not the life that I set out to have, but it's what my life is right now. And if I can help one mom, it makes it all worth it.
Talking to Lisa Hillman, the author of Secret No More, a book that you can get now, and that is all about a family's grappling with addiction of her son. And before we get into Jacob's path, why don't you tell me your feelings as a parent that you reflect in many places in the book, the way that I'm sure you've heard from those kinds of parents who say, this wasn't the life that I thought I would have or the situation I thought I would be grappling with, because there can be moments where you think, how could this have happened? Did I fail in some way? And that is such a common thought for parents. What was it like for you?
Again, having this child sort of late in life and having raised already one healthy daughter and seeing her grow up and get married and move on, it was shocking to me that there would be any kind of addiction in our household. They say there is a genetic link. There was none in our family. So I was totally unprepared for that phone call late on an August night at the beginning of Jacob's high school year, where this beloved teacher says to me, Lisa, friends have come to me. They think Jacob is using. He's hanging around with the wrong crowd. And I'm thinking, must have the wrong kid. From that point on, for too long, I tried to not believe that this was my son. Jacob's tall. He's handsome. He's smart. It's the classic case of a great kid who somehow falls prey to addiction. Looking back on it, I can say that. But going through it, I was so ashamed. I was so afraid that anyone would find out, even the people at work. I worked in a healthcare setting. I worked in a very large, it's Maryland's third fastest growing hospital. Every day I was surrounded by doctors and nurses and people who are caregivers. And yet I was ashamed to let them know that there was this horrid family, a horrid situation hiding in my own family.
You know, your son Jacob, every person who gets into addiction has a slightly different path. And I don't want to frame this as, well, your son's path is emblematic of every person who would ever be addicted or has been addicted. But I do think it's worth just kind of exploring how it happened. Because as you said, you know, people would come to you and say, well, I'm worried who he's hanging out with or what's he doing. So take me through the path of the consumption, the drugs that he ended up with and what you were sort of witnessing in his progression.
So I think you're right. It's a good question. It's important to kind of trace his path, even though the story, and as he says, Mom, this is your story, not mine. But I think it is important because it's against his journey. As I said, it started, I was first alerted by that phone call from a high school teacher. He said Jacob might be drinking and he might be using marijuana. So Jacob went basically from drinking, and that wasn't really quote-unquote his drug of choice, to marijuana, and then Oxy, then the pills. OxyContin took over. And if any of your listeners are following that story at all, you know how addictive that can be and what a scourge that is in our country right now. But that also caught up my son. This was the years of 2008 and 9. He left high school, went to the University of Maryland College Park for freshman year in the honors program. As he tells it, that was a lost year. He was trying everything. College introduced him to drugs that he hadn't yet experienced. So while I don't know for sure everything that he's used, I suspect he's tried most things. But that was clearly a lost year. That year, then he came home. We told him he could come home as long as he had a plan. His plan was to go to the community college and to work, which he did. They also were not great years. He did work. He did stay in the college, community college. He almost finished to getting his associate's degree, but then the drugs took over. And along the way, I finally started getting some help for him and for me. We both went to a therapist, a pretty good one in the Annapolis area, who saw Jake. We had some not so good ones early on, but we finally found one that was helpful. Nevertheless, Jay continued using, and it finally got to a point where I said to my son, my beloved 21-year-old son, and believe me, I would have cut off an arm to cure him at that point. I said to him, Jacob, if you're going to be using, you can't stay in our house. you have a choice. You can leave, which meant he would continue to use, or we'll pay for rehab. He took rehab. He wasn't ready, but he knew that he had nowhere to go. He took rehab. He tried the first inpatient rehab center at a very, very beautiful place in Maryland. I knew when we visited him that he had somehow had gotten drugs into the rehab center. They kicked him out. He came home to Annapolis, went to our rehab center that's part of the health system where I was working. And how odd was that? I'm on the board of that center, and here's my son, a patient upstairs. After 2 weeks, they sent him to Florida, where he continued his rehab. Not such a good first year, but after that first year, he ended up actually quite ill. He was injecting heroin before it was all over. And even as I say that today, Evan, the thought of my son sticking needles and poison into his veins just makes me still cringe today. It's still very, very, very surreal. After that weekend, fortunately, a friend found him and took him into detox. A counselor called me and said, your son needs rehab. Will you pay for this? Rehab is expensive. And I said, how many times do I have to pay for this? He said, tell your son, this is the last time. I said, Jacob, Dad and I will pay for this. It's the last time. It was a 90-day program. Thank God it was a 90-day program. The first time he'd been in that long. Something happened to him in that 90 days. He found a sponsor. He found AA, even though his drug was hard drugs, not alcohol. He found AA. He got a job. He moved to a recovery halfway house, stayed with the same job actually for the next 5 years, and has been clean now for 5.5 years.
Hmm. Now, as you went through that process, I believe you wrote in the book that, you know, by the time he was on OxyContin, you had never really heard much about it. You didn't know much about that, correct?
I didn't even know how to spell it. And even today, I mean, in writing the book, I had to look up, how do you spell OxyContin? Where does that N go? Is there a capital C? So, no, I had never heard of it.
Yeah, it was almost to the point where you said you wished he was just smoking weed because that's what a lot of kids do. And that would have been easier for you, as you said, to kind of get up, go to work and say, okay, my son's, you know, dealing with issues or, you know, he smokes a little marijuana, but a lot of kids do. He can deal with that. Was it a kind of a sense of making it easier for you, or were you just in the process of really discovering how serious that was?
So early on, I thought this can't be serious. They can't really be overly concerned about Jacob because all kids smoke, right? All kids drink. I figured it was just the high school's rite of passage. And that was part of my denial. I thought, this is just normal. He's just going through some normal 18-year-old phase, and he'll grow out of it. Why did he become addicted, and the friends with whom he was drinking and smoking didn't? That's a question that I can't answer. Maybe the experts can. But Jacob did become addicted. Others didn't.
There was a point in the story where you wrote, I think, a question that I want to explore a little bit here. And it was a question on what pain is like and why someone like Jacob would experience pain. And you would write this, quote, later he would tell me, a friend from Towson texted me about prices of Oxy. I went to Towson to get it, and it took away the pain. The phrase baffled Dick and me. What pain? As non-addicts, could we ever understand what that meant, especially in a family where a child was given everything he wanted or needed? Jacob had parents who adored him, a sister who cared deeply for him, and sufficient means to meet nearly all of his desires. So why this? Why drugs? It wasn't supposed to be like this, not in my family, not my son. End quote. All right, listeners, thanks for hanging in there with us. We've just had a few technical issues. I think we've got them licked. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Lisa Hillman. She is the author of the new book. It's called Secret No More. And her book is all about a true story of hope for parents with an addicted child. She has opened up to tell the story of her son, Jacob, and what her family went through. And before our last little disruption, I was asking Lisa about this passage she writes in her book about trying to understand a son who is describing a life of pain. And for Lisa, as a mother, you're going, well, you know, you have material comfort. You have everything that you really need. You've got loving parents. You have a loving sibling. You've got family that is there for you. There's nothing really that should be lacking in your life. Where is the pain coming from? And Lisa, in my experience, this question comes up for people who are struggling with friends and family who get into drugs, and also friends and family who are depressed. Because sometimes you look at people and you say, well, you should be happy. Why can't you just be happy? Take me through that struggle you had with Jacob, what he would say to you, and how you sort of dealt with that, how you and Dick dealt with that.
When Jacob was very little, he fell down and cracked an arm. He complained of pain, and I thought, it didn't feel broken, it didn't look broken. And it actually took several days before I took him to see an orthopedic surgeon who x-rayed it and said, indeed, there was a minor little fracture inside the bone that was causing pain. And I looked at him and thought, you know what? I should never doubt my son again when he says to me, I'm in pain. That pain I could understand. That was a broken bone. Years later, I had such difficulty understanding the pain that he told me he was in, the pain of that was causing his addiction. Another way he describes that, or has described it to me since, is he knew somewhere, actually he says now in junior high, that he was different. He just didn't feel like he was fitting in, that there was a hole inside of him, that drugs and alcohol filled that hole and made him feel quote-unquote normal, made him feel like he fit in. Again, that's his description. So that helps me to understand why he has that, I don't know. The fact that he does have it, I accept that now. The challenge is if you take the drugs and alcohol away, then the hole is still there. What else will fill that hole? And the way he describes that to me is that's where his recovery comes in. That's where a spiritual component in his life has helped him to recover and stay well.
Are you confident now, 5+ years in, that that component is, for lack of a better term, permanent?
Evan, any parent who's watched a son or daughter or anyone, and you know yourself, when you have a friend who's addicted, of course not. Addiction is a chronic, lifelong situation. I think of it as a disease, but you can just say it's a condition. It's chronic. It's lifelong. I know that threat will always be there. That's why I focus on one day at a time. Today is a good day. Today he is healthy. Today I am healthy. And really, today is all we have.
Can you tell our listeners what for you felt like the bottom? How bad it got with your son? And what was the moment that you felt like it could not get worse?
I recall that situation very vividly, and I do write about that in the book. I'm a gym person. I like to stay fit. I'm not a youngster, so exercise is important. I try to do all the right things, eat well, and so on, even though I skipped breakfast this morning. But I do go to the gym. And during those years, particularly when I was working full-time and had a very, very demanding, very public position, I would go to the gym at 5:30 or 6 in the morning to start my day. At the gym, you know, you can be both sociable and alone. And it was at the gym where I heard music that reminded me so much of my son. I would close my eyes and think about him and fight back the tears, knowing that probably no one was looking at me. Everybody was too busy doing their own thing. But one day I was feeling particularly distressed about Jacob. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm his mom. If I can't fix him, if I can't, quote-unquote, cure my son, then I guess I've failed my basic earthly purpose. I'm a mother. Mothers raise healthy children, and I'm not doing that. I'm failing at that. So I was feeling very, very low, very, very depressed, and the thought crossed my mind, pretty sad and sick, looking back on it, if this is the way it's going to be, if he's going to slowly kill himself, then I have the option of checking out as well. At that moment, a woman appeared in front of me whom I hadn't seen for years. She's fairly well known in the Annapolis community. And she looked at me and said, hi, how are you? And she said, how is your family? And I said, well, my son's not doing so well, but I shrugged my shoulders. And she said, you know, kids go through this. And I said, yeah, high school kids go through this. And she said, then I remembered, before she said the next thing, I remembered, oh my gosh, that woman lost her 11-year-old son in a freak swimming accident not too long ago. And I looked at her and she said to me, "Lisa, as long as they're alive, there's hope."
Talking to Lisa Hillman, and when it came now to the decisions you had to make, you touched on it before. We have talked to other guests on this program who have had to make the decision on what to do about a child who is trying to get clean, or sometimes not really trying to get clean, maybe going through the motions. We talked to parents about 6 months ago who struggled with that very question for their own son who had stolen money from them and felt like we have to give an ultimatum and that it might be a loving thing to say you can't live here anymore. But how do you grapple with that question? How can it be a loving thing to say this is an ultimatum and we could cast you out for right now in your life? Tell me about that from a parent perspective, Lisa.
The irony, Evan, is that today Jacob and I and my husband fairly often will talk to groups of families. And when Jacob is home in Annapolis with us, he now lives in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And by the way, he'd be happy to help any young person struggling. But when he's home, we often talk at Pathways, which is our local substance abuse treatment center. When that subject comes up about our telling him, giving him the ultimatum to leave, he once in a while will lean over and say to me, so the families can hear it, "What took you so long?" So setting boundaries with your children is acceptable. Is a good thing. We set boundaries with our kids when we're raising them all the time. What can't they eat? What time do they have to be home? And so on and so on. And as they get older, it's a lot harder because we want to give them freedoms and we don't feel like they're ready to accept them. But when addiction takes over, it does complicate everything. So we needed advice from the outside. And anybody that's going through this, I would say get some advice from somebody you trust, whether it's a therapist or a counseling center. But it is okay to set boundaries. The most problems that I see, and again, Evan, I'm not an expert. I'm one mom with one story. But the problems that I see with my friends in Al-Anon, we go to Al-Anon pretty regularly, is that they are too permissive with their children. There's a term, enabling, that's gotten, it's pretty common in addiction today. They enable their children too much. And as my son has said and others have said, you can enable your child to death.
That is such a frightening question, though, for parents, because, you know, you have to come up with a line somewhere. How many chances is enough? How many chances is too many? When does it become enabling? When is it still the right thing to do to provide sort of a safety net? And there's no probably easy answer. But beyond that concern about enabling, what would you say to a parent who might say to you, you know, look, I understand your experience, but I can't send a child out of this house knowing that they are addicted, knowing that they've been stealing money, that they might commit crimes, you know, that it might feel like it's enabling to keep them, but if I send them out and they die, I'll never be able to think about that. What would you say to that parent?
Again, I'm not a therapist and I'm not a counselor, but I can only speak from my experience. But my experience would tell me if we had not given Jacob an ultimatum when we did, who's to say that he wouldn't have died upstairs in his bedroom?
Yeah. Yeah. And you had plenty of moments where you wonder what you would find in his room, didn't you?
Again, that's the ignorance. What I found in his bedroom, and anybody who's listening who understands addiction will probably screech at this, what we found on his bedroom floor were small patches of aluminum foil with a dark, smudgy charcoal line up the middle. It wasn't until years later that I realized, that what that was.
We're talking about addiction, and we're going to get our only break of the hour. When we come back, we're going to talk about stigma, the stigma of addiction. A lot of people who don't have family or friends who have gone through addiction, again, as we said, right at the outside of the hour, you might have ideas on how you envision what addiction looks like, particularly for harder drugs, for the OxyContins of the world, for the heroines of the world. What does it look like in your mind? And then what does it look like in reality? We're going to ask Lisa about that. We're going to talk about cost, insurance, all the questions that you work with for, dealing with this. And then families that may have questions who might feel like, well, we don't know if we can what we do in this kind of situation. What did she learn about the system and how well the system does or doesn't work, and the opioid epidemic at large? Lisa Hillman, my guest, the author of the book Secret No More. It's out now. She's joining us in Baltimore via ISDN, and we're grateful to have her. Let's take our only break of the hour and come right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, comedian Tina Fey had a response to Charlottesville, something that has been called sheet cake feminism. But many feminists of color have said she missed the point, and her response was all about white privilege and how women need to be better allies for each other. We'll discuss it. Then in our second hour, we preview the Rochester Fringe Festival, hear from many of the people who will be performing. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Want to let you know, in conjunction with this interview, I think it's a good time to remind you that a new season of Second Opinion, the Emmy Award-nominated public television series, is coming. It launches its 14th season in October, and they explore this subject that we are talking about today with our guest. And so let me just give you a little summation of what Second Opinion is going to explore. I can tell you, having been in the building when there were a lot of the recordings going on there, there were some very emotional, powerful hours of conversation happening. And so here's the story that Second Opinion is going to cover when their season launches in October. Just 8 weeks after their son Patrick died of a heroin overdose, Mary and Joe Mullen courageously share their story in a one-hour special called Second Opinion: Overdose Inside the Epidemic. They tell their very personal experience of Patrick's decline from alcohol and marijuana use into opioid and then heroin addiction. A close-knit family, the Mullins watched their son grow from a happy infant into a star lacrosse player and student. But even as he was surrounded by a loving family and friends, his addiction took over his life. And in front of a live studio audience, the Second Opinion Overdose Inside the Epidemic panel of experts discusses the drug epidemic in the U.S., offers advice about how to recognize the signs and symptoms of drug abuse, and gives cutting-edge information on prevention and effective treatment. That is coming your way in October with a new season of Second Opinion. And Lisa, how much does that sound like your life? That's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, Evan, I've had a chance to kind of take a look at what you all are planning, and that sounds excellent. So congratulations to you and to your station for putting all that together. The only suggestion I had, and I'm saying this publicly on the air now, is don't forget the voice of the addict. I have learned and continue to learn so much from my son. He's really become my teacher of addiction. He's a very profound young man these days, something he would not have been. He would not be where he is, I think, quite as profound had he not gone through this. So don't forget to listen to what the addicts can tell you too.
We're talking to Lisa Hillman, and let's talk about a number of issues related to what happened with her family. I mentioned stereotypes. I mentioned the way we think about addiction. Now, Lisa mentioned earlier, she didn't even know what OxyContin was. Her son ends up moving from marijuana into that, and then all of a sudden, as a parent, you don't know what the drug even is that your child is doing. You may have had stereotypes. You know, I'm sure our listeners have an image in their mind when they think about heroin addiction or OxyContin addiction. For me, Lisa, the first time I encountered OxyContin, I was a reporter in West Virginia, where there has been certainly an epidemic there, probably even more serious and widespread than we even see at the national level. But I didn't know what it was. It was a big learning experience for me just to report on it. What was your vision in your mind about addiction in these various drugs, and how did that compare then to what you were discovering?
While Jacob was falling into addiction during this time, Evan, honestly, I looking back on those years, I was so ignorant, even though I worked in a health system and was fairly knowledgeable talk to me about cancer or osteoporosis or anything else. But when it came to addiction, I was pretty much, believe it or not, pretty much clueless. I never thought it would reach our family. I had years and years and years ago worked as a vocational rehab counselor, so I understood alcoholism quite a bit. And I understood that alcoholism can affect anyone, but these hard drugs were quite new to me. I had to go to the website, I had to ask friends, I had to educate myself. And the more I did, actually, the more ashamed I was and the more worried and fearful I was. Part of my denial of my son's disease was, if he had this addiction and I faced it, I had no idea what to do about it.
Now, you look back, would you have done anything differently?
That's a great question. And of course, I ask myself that all the time. And I ask my son that all the time. What did I do? What didn't I do? Should I have been home at 3 o'clock when you came home from school with milk and cookies? Should I have taken you to the piano lessons a little longer? You know, where did I fail? And what addiction teaches you, it's the three C's. It teaches you very quickly that you didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you certainly can't cure it. Looking back, other than that, the only thing I think I would have done differently is move on him a little sooner. By that I mean give him the boundaries sooner. Even he says, what took you so long to kick me out of the house?
We have a couple of questions before I get to those that come from listeners. I want to ask you, Lisa, if you have any anger at you know, maybe the opioid industry or anything that might have put your son in that kind of pathway. You go back especially 20 years or so in this country, a lot changed that cranked up the opioid industry. Certainly medical professionals have told us on this program that there were some big mistakes made. How do you feel about that as a parent?
Well, Devin, I'm not angry. I don't think there's anger. You know, I have done a lot of reading. In fact, I recommend a book called Dreamland, if I may, by Sam Kanonis, who just finished that book, which does an excellent job of tracking everything you've just said, how OxyContin and heroin have taken over our country. I'm not angry. I think there is a lot of greed in America. A lot of the greed drives the drug trade. Where I am is disappointed in how we're facing it. I wish we took these young people and gave them the treatment and the recovery they need. A weekend detox, a two-week stay, a 30-day stay is just, for most kids, most young people, most addicts, not sufficient. We need longer treatment and varied treatment for people who are addicted, and I don't think we're approaching it the way that we possibly could.
Does the system work when it comes to insurance? What you just shared lines up with what we've heard from other families who felt like getting clean, getting rehabbed, et cetera, was not nearly enough, that it was almost set up for failure. But what about what you've learned about the system at large? What other changes would you like to see?
Part of the problem is our own culture. You know, we move fast. I know that. We want quick fixes for things. Just like the addict, we want to be satisfied immediately. So as a parent, I want you to fix my son. If I give him to you, will you bring him back to me in 2 weeks so he can get back to school? I don't want him to miss school. Will you fix him in 30 days? So it's partly our own fault. But clearly the system's not set up that way. We don't treat all cancers the same way, so we can't treat all addictions the same way. We need much longer and much more varied programs. One of the models that is working, and I'm familiar with it, had the opportunity to visit this a year ago, is actually in Italy. And I would encourage your listeners to look up a place called San Patrignano in Italy. It's a place where 1,200 addicts live up to 3 years for free. It's an amazing program, and even better, studies have shown that more than 70% of them after 3 years are addiction-free. So there are models around the world that work. Why aren't we testing them in America?
Okay, so some ideas from Lisa on what's going on here. Let's get some of your questions. Matt writes to the program and says, your guest said she found pieces of tinfoil in her son's room and didn't know what they were until later. What are they used for?
So I'm hoping maybe if I say this wrong, that one of your listeners will correct me, but one can crush any pill. It could crush a pill, crush Oxy, and snort it.
So it's just a evidence that he was using, in other words, there.
Correct, for you. Correct.
Yeah. An email from, let me just grab this here. Michelle just wants to know about social stigma. We've talked a lot about drug addicts themselves. What about for family? Did your guest have any problems with her social circles? That's an interesting question, Michelle. Did you worry about that, Lisa?
It's huge, Michelle. Thank you so much for that question. That's actually why I wrote the book, why it's called Secret No More. I kept my son's addiction secret for years, at least I thought I did. In fact, when the book came out, a lot of my very close friends said, Lisa, I had no idea you were going through this. Yes, indeed, the shame kept the social circles that I traveled in, you didn't talk about your child's addiction. Your child was not addicted in the social circles that I've traveled in. So absolutely, it was a huge problem for me. In fact, I'll share another revealing fact. When Jacob was sent to Florida, a therapist said to me, okay, your son will have his program. Now, what are you going to do for yourself? I had no idea that my son's addiction was making me as sick as it was. And it wasn't until he asked me that question I realized I'm depressed, I'm obsessed with him, I'm not functioning well, I'm crying and not sleeping. So I tried Al-Anon, and actually it was Al-Anon that saved me. The very first time I went, I couldn't open my mouth for crying. The second time I went, wouldn't you know it, one of my board members walked in. And I literally, the cliche, you wish the floor would swallow you up. I actually was looking at the floor waiting for the hole to swallow me up. Mm-hmm. But I had to sit there and take it. She sat next to me and she looked at me and I looked at her, and it was immediate understanding of each other's situations.
In fact, I was just going to read from one of those sections, but you beat me to it. Did you, if you were to go back, it's one thing to say, what would you have done differently? Would you have gone back to advise yourself, all of the fear of stigma that you might have in social circles or in work circles, try to let that go as much as you can?
If I had advised Lisa Hillman years ago, I would say, what took you so long to tell someone? What took you so long to find Al-Anon? What took you so long to get stronger yourself? What took you so long to get healthy yourself? Whether or not your son got healthy, you know, we're worth saving too. We, the families of the addicts, we're worth getting well and being taken care of also. So what took me so long to realize that?
So what happens next for your family? Let's spend the remainder of the hour talking about how you see solutions and you know how things are going now, because as painful as it's been, there's maybe no easy answer. I asked about sort of permanence, and I know you kind of brushed that off, totally understandably, because nothing ever feels permanent in terms of a solution. You're always sort of on guard as a family with addiction in the family. But what is in your mind best case for your son and also for your family now?
Great question, Heaven. Best case for my son, first, is that he will stay healthy. And, you know, when addiction hits, all your expectations fly. I had to learn to let go of all my expectations for Jacob. Never let go of hope, but let go of expectations. And it got to a point where all I wanted was for him to be healthy. And by that, I mean drug-free. That was my only hope. Today he is drug-free, and I stay focused on that. The rest will come. As long as he is drug-free, he'll figure out the rest of his life. I need to let him be his own person, be his own man. I need to be the mother that he needs today, which means I need to stand away from him and let him fall, let him make mistakes. There's nothing I can do in that regard anyway. So my hope for him is that he will stay drug-free, but that's his role. I can't affect that. I will never stop loving him, no matter what he's doing, but I can't keep him healthy that way. For us, for myself and my husband and our family, we will continue going to Al-Anon. I think we still go to an Al-Anon meeting once a week. It's pretty religious for us. It's changed since we're not living with active addiction, but we go to ground ourselves, we go to give back to others, and we go to remind ourselves that this is a lifelong situation, and we're healthy and grateful for that today.
How often do you talk to Jacob?
Well, we actually talk every day for at least a minute. There's another story to that, but both my children phone me, and we talk. That's thanks to a rabbi who suggested that about 2 years ago. But both my children, adults, will call, and we speak for about 60 seconds just to check in. My husband laughs because he hasn't talked to them now for years because they call me. But we do talk every day. We spend a lot of time together. My husband and I go to Florida in January. And during that time, we go to meetings, a lot of AA meetings with Jacob, and continue to learn about addiction and what it means.
Debbie writes to the program and says, Evan, I missed the earlier part of this hour, so forgive me if this has been covered, but so much of this sounds like issues with depression. Does your guest, I'm sorry, it's a kind of a long email. I'm just thank you, Debbie, for it's a great question. Debbie just wants to know, does your guest child, does he struggle with depression, and is that part of the scene here? Debbie, thank you for the email. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, Debbie, thank you. That's a great question. And depression is very common with addiction. To answer specifically, I don't know. Jacob was never, that I know of, diagnosed with depression. There were times when I clearly thought he was depressed, particularly when he was using. Today, I wouldn't say so. So I don't know. I can tell you it's pretty common, though, with addiction that that depression's part of it.
Yeah, Carol, a different listener, Carol, had a similar question. She just wanted to know, a question for your guest, was the pain related to a mental illness diagnosis? But again, the answer to that, Lisa, is?
In Jacob's case, not that I know of, but again, that's pretty common.
So, Carol and Debbie, thank you for those questions. I want to read a section toward the end of the book here, but I think it sets the scene of, again, kind of grappling with what you're seeing. And then I'll ask Lisa to tell me a little bit more about the moment she's describing. You write, to one of the highlights of our weekend together, talking about in Florida, odd though it seems, was going to AA meetings with him. In Delray, meetings are so commonplace, there's even a designated building for them called Crossroads. A single-story, nondescript structure alongside railroad tracks, Crossroads offers meetings all day, every day. Depending on the type of meeting, the crowd tends to look a little rough. Lots of earrings and tattoos, men in jeans and black leather, girls in short skirts sporting streaks of fuchsia-colored hair. Seated next to my son, given a window on this anonymous world, I watched how both men and women hugged and high-fived one another. They sat next to those they knew, shook hands with some of the much older guys, settled down in the folding chairs for the formal start of the meeting, and it struck me. They're all the same. They may look tougher or rougher than Jacob, but they all have this very same thing in common. They are all addicts, like my son, and it makes me shudder today to recall how I first viewed that scene. It forced me to say the words to myself, my son is an addict, end quote. So, again, when you say you first viewed that scene, I assume what you were looking at were the differences as opposed to the similarities, yes?
Yes. Jacob is pretty clean cut. He wears pretty clean clothes. He doesn't have tattoos. And so I looked at that other crowd, other quote unquote, as being a lot rougher and tougher. But having spent so many evenings now with a lot of these young people, not so young, you know, people's in their 30s and 40s as well, I realize how much alike we really all are.
Lisa, throughout the book, you share such personal moments and views that you've had with your son's addiction, including the way some people guard themselves against possible problems. You learn not to assume that you can fix everything overnight or maybe ever. You worry about that. What would you say to parents who pick up your book because they're struggling in the same way and they want that cure? They want to make it all better, to make it sort of all go away, and they're going to be dealing with the ups and downs. What would you say to those kind of families?
I'd say, first of all, take a deep breath. If you're just starting in on this journey and you're just realizing that you have a child who has an addiction, go easy on yourself. Get some help for yourself and educate yourself. You know, one of the best things that happened to me was being able to go to AA meetings. That didn't come till a little bit later, but and I've asked Jacob about this. If there's any way that you can get yourself to an AA meeting, or find someone who's gone through it, I mean, someone like myself, or an Al-Anon meeting, go to an Al-Anon meeting for sure. Just because your child has an addiction doesn't mean it's going to be a bad ending. It could just as well be a good ending. So take it one day at a time. Please educate yourself. Be good to yourself. Find help. Tell someone you trust. And never give up hope.
How hard are those relapses or those downturns? I mean, I can recall in the book you talk about those moments where you thought, okay, things are stabilizing. He's working as a barista now. You're hearing from people in the community who would come back and say, you know, you got a great kid, and you know what a nice young man your son is. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, you know, we're going to be okay. And then the next thing you know, things turn in a different direction again. How hard are those moments?
They're very hard. But again, I can speak from perspective. They say that relapse can be part of recovery. So if an addict relapses, it doesn't mean that he or she has forgotten what he learned during recovery. The longer the recovery periods, the better. But the addict can never really let his or her guard down. Addiction is just waiting like a monster to grab them again. So the more active they are in their own programs or whatever it is that's going to keep them sober and clean and healthy, the better. For those of us who love them, the same is true. Go to Al-Anon, find a group, stay focused on your own health and your own recovery. We are separate beings, and we have to let our children find their own way.
Looking back, are you at all surprised that your own family has held together so strongly through this, Lisa?
I don't think I'm surprised. We were a strong family to begin with. I think family is important. In an addict's recovery, they say that the kids or the young people that make it usually do have some strong family behind them. I did determine early on that my son's addiction was not going to destroy the marriage. That can happen. So my husband and I got together and realized we were two people together. Whatever we decided for Jacob or about Jacob, we would decide together, that he would not divide us, although he tried. So, and kids will do that when they're healthy, let alone when they're addicted. So no, I'm not surprised. I think our family is a whole lot stronger today even than we were before.
What a great story about making that decision that you're going to link arms and you're going to make these decisions together. You're going to try not to question one another or bring each other down or blame. And you clearly have done it, Lisa. I just admire you and your family. I know you've really opened it up with this book. The book is called Secret No More, A True Story of Hope for Parents with an Addicted Child. It is out now. And I certainly think that there are families out there who will have the pain and the surprise of going through what you went through. But hopefully you've offered them a bit of a roadmap. Thanks for taking the time for this program this hour.
Evan, thank you.
Lisa Hillman, the author of Secret No More and Just One More Voice. You know, listeners, I know to some degree over the recent years, the last couple of years in particular, we've talked a lot about opioid addiction, heroin-related issues. And we're not going to stop until it's gone. And unfortunately, we have seen nothing but an increase. So our thanks to Lisa Hillman and everyone who's willing to share their story and reach out and help others in need. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer of this broadcast. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.